the Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the final stream for tonight, and it is with Praise of Folly. I don't know, am I allowed to say your real name on here?
Yeah, you can say it.
Todd from Praise of Folly. So Todd has been on several times before, most recently 2 years ago, I believe, if I recall correctly. And he's always a very interesting speaker. The last time, I should perhaps say this, that the last time I cut it short because I thought you'd sort of taken us through a whole load of stuff so quickly and concisely that I thought if we go on after this point, it's just going to be extra. It's going to be superfluous because this has been so interesting. And I think it was 40 minutes. And but some people didn't like it. Some people said that was rude of you and all this. So if you are offended by that, Todd, I just want to say I apologize. But I thought it was a tremendous stream, and that was why I cut it short. But nonetheless, leaving that aside, welcome back to Millennial. And would you like to introduce yourself briefly to anyone who doesn't know of you?
Yes. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm Todd Lewis of the Praise of Folly podcast. I've been around since 2016. I cover all sorts of content: history, philosophy, current events, religion, economics. Last year, a lot of people might have noticed that a friend and I were going through Moldbug's old backlog, escaping the Moldbug matrix. That might be where a lot of growth happened last year there. And basically it's what I want to talk about, but that's a whole wide gamut that I'm sure anybody in your audience would find something enjoyable, whether it's history or religion or metapolitics or economics or whatever.
All right. And what you wanted to talk about this time is really the mechanics of collapse and how human beings should react to it and deal with it. So there was a question that I was going to ask you about the plan of the elites last year. Before we get to the matter of collapse, could you briefly talk about that? Because obviously things have changed again with Ukraine failing and now the Gaza conflict. Before we get to the actual matter, would you like to talk about that with regard to your ideas about the elite plan or Agenda 2030, COVID, the WEF from a couple of years ago? How is that? What is your thinking there in terms of the elites and their plan for the future?
Right. So there was a video I did last year with the funny title, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Great Reset. And the idea was, is this a controlled demolition? Are there members of the elite that see the writing on the wall for industrial civilization and are preemptively destroying it? So for example, let's use the analogy of a forest fire. Let's say that you know you have a forest with a lot of old dead wood. You might preemptively start a fire to control it so that you can then remove the hazard of the fire in the forest. And if you think of it like that, then they could see some segment of the elites, I believe, see that this is coming. And what they're doing is they're trying to have a controlled burn before it happens. So if a process is coming and you at least are in control of it, that gives you a better chance of being in control after.
Right. Yes. And where do you think that is now, though? Because obviously, so I would say that the Great Reset was, they don't talk about it so much now at all. It's really fallen away. The slogan Build Back Better is gone. So what do you think has happened with all of that?
Right. So on the one hand, Okay, Lenin once said that you need to take one step backward to take two steps forward. The idea being that once you have reached a certain limit of propaganda efficacy, you want to walk it back. So for example, right, we see army recruitment commercials with a positive portrayal of white men, which means, oh, they're getting ready for a war, right? They have to dial it back now, getting rid of the whole stinker of the lesbian recruiting video. That didn't work. So they're taking a step back. Now, I would argue that does not mean a change of policy. It's this sort of like Leninist strategy of repositioning yourself so that you can continue doing what you're already doing, but distracting people with something else. So a war, let's say in Ukraine or Gaza, what it will do is it will distract people from the plan that they're still unfolding. Because, so for example, the sort of denuclearization is still going on, I'm pretty sure. The idea of shutting down more plants is, Biden claims he's going to build some, microchip plants here in the States. But he kind of has to at this point because of the geostrategic issues. Now, this could represent another element of the deep state gaining influence because of strategic interests, right? We've always had the neocons, the military-industrial complex. That's one element. And I don't think they're collapsitarians. They're probably not. And this could be also a revolving door where, like, hey, guys, we allowed you to play this hand of Build Back Better and collapse and Green New Deal, and it didn't work. So now it's our turn. It could be handing off the baton as well.
Sorry, I was just dealing with a technical issue there. So do you think that... I understand the thinking that it's basically give them a break before pushing ahead. So let them recharge, let them relax, let them feel that things are back to normal, and then push ahead. I understand that, rather than constant advance of the agenda. But what you've just said there, and denuclearization is also happening in Europe. I know that Germany did it this year. It just seems crazy. But then that's maybe what we're talking about. That what seems crazy is actually part of an agenda. But you also said that the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza conflict would serve as part of an agenda. So would I be right in thinking that you don't think these are events that intervene on an agenda, that an elite has cooked up, a plan? Rather, these events are actually part of it.
Yeah, I think actually there's competition within the elite circles. And so, depending on what happens in the real world, what will happen then is they might adjust their strategy. So for example, as a sort of crass example, imagine a bunch of guys playing cards around a table and they represent elements of the deep state. And they're all basically viewing the world as one giant game that they're playing. And so a window on this was during the siege of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, when the French were being besieged by the North Vietnamese. CIA agents were just placing bets on when the French would fall. Right? It was a game to them. It was a game, right? Well, you lost your initiative. Now it's my turn. And so it could be that, or it could be the Leninist one step back, two steps forward, or it could be the intra-elite civil war, right? People talk about how Trump represents this intra-elite civil war that's brewing, both with the deep state versus Trump, but also within the deep state. So we could see a cracking of any coherent plan at all.
Yeah, and there's also the idea that the Pentagon is quite different from DC and other power centers in America. Okay, so I guess that brings us to the issue of collapse itself. I mean, one other notion here that I should bring in beforehand is the idea that the elite don't have a vision for the future. There is no West in 2040, 2060, 2090. It's really what they're doing just now is just shutting it all down. At least there won't be a public West, a general thing like we've known in the past. It's maybe a West for the elite, might be a life, a world for the elite. But for the masses, it will be God knows what. And in which case, what they're doing just now is shutting it all down. Would you agree with that?
I would. because we've also seen a lot of analysts say that, like in Europe, they predict capital flight from Germany and other European countries back to America, which would have the effect of deindustrializing Europe. Which, of course, deindustrializing Germany was part of the Morgenthau Plan of 1945. But now all of Europe seems to be at risk of deindustrialization.
Yeah, it's a frightening thing. Because I just can't imagine. Remember, this was a big thing last millennial. A lot of people were talking about this because Nord Stream had just happened and there was the energy crisis, the threat of that. Well, it wasn't just a threat, it was a reality. The energy prices went up through the roof. And the prospect of Germany ceasing to be an industrial powerhouse and becoming something else, deindustrializing. That seems incredible. So let's get to the matter of collapse then. You tell me, or tell the audience rather, what do you think is really playing out here?
Right. So I think first let's define what I mean by collapse, and then we can then talk about, is it actually happening? So a lot of times, you know, it's thrown around in a kind of colloquial sense. We might think of like a Hollywood movie where something just, you know, Armageddon or Independence Day or whatever, there's some disaster that wipes out 2012. But here I'm using collapse in a technical sense. So Joseph Tainter defines collapse as moving from a high energy state to a low energy state. And a high energy state tends to have complex interdependent systems that are fragile, whereas a low energy state tends to have redundant systems which are resilient. And so what ends up happening is he talks about the overinvestments in complexity. So you have these interlocking complex systems that are all dependent upon one another. It kind of creates what we might call an upside down pyramid. And on top of that, they're energy hungry. So in engineering, there's a principle called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. These systems are not simple. And the reason why KISS exists as a slogan is the more parts that can break in a system, the more likely it is to break. Okay. And then the other aspect about collapse is that it's catabolic, as John Michael Greer states, and by catabolic, what I mean is this: there is a point at which the cost of maintaining the capital stock and its infrastructure exceed the society's ability to grow new capital. The value of economic growth then is eaten up by maintaining old capital stock rather than producing something new. Now, that then leads to phased stages. So you know, you cannibalize part of the system, it falls to equilibrium. Then it starts to collapse again. And then you have to cannibalize more stuff and it falls to equilibrium. And that process keeps repeating until you reach a low energy state, which whatever that happens to be. Now, the mechanism then is what, if that's what collapse looks like in a formal sense, what's the mechanism? The concept of EROI, energy return on energy investment. So an energy return on energy investment is it's a calculation. So it's where the energy delivered is divided by the energy required to deliver that energy. So when the EROI is equal to or less than one, it becomes an energy sink whereby it can no longer be used as an energy source. So imagine a predatory animal. That animal must consume more energy in the kill than it took him to make the kill, otherwise he dies. So for energy consumption, like say oil in a modern industrial society, EROIs used to be really good. Texas rigs in the 30s and 40s would do 100 to 1. One barrel in, you get 100 out. Now with fracking, depending on the figures you look at, it's down to 3 to 1, still kind of sustainable, or 0.7 to 1, which is absolutely not sustainable. And we've seen the decline from 100 to down to 3 to 1. And at that point, if this continues, we get to a point where it's an energy sink and petrocarbons are no longer a valid fuel source. And since they buttress all of modern industrial society, that would be the mechanism by which collapse occurs.
And, well, yeah, okay, so what would that mean for ordinary life? It's a bit of a naive question.
Sure. So for ordinary life, ultimately what collapse means when it's all done, from my perspective, is that we're going to be living in a state that is pre-industrial. So if anybody's, you know, now how far back that goes, does that mean a medieval way of life? Does that mean a Renaissance, 1700s? That's not clear because, of course, there'll still be leftover wreckage of civilization. probably the best example from history would be the Western Roman Empire. So you have these dense urban settlements with roads and aqueducts, and then they just all fall apart. And then you just have these, you know, rural, you know, petty kingdoms and raiding tribes taking over. And so you have this very, so rather than urban and highly developed, it'll be rural and not very well developed. And instead of having high technology, it'll be low technology.
So this would be a, how long do you think it would take? I mean, speculating, what kind of time frame are we talking about? A century from now that we would be living like this? 50 years, 200 years?
So with, yeah, I would say going to all the way down to what I would call the new equilibrium. Because, right, if the collapse is phased, I would argue we're already in it. John Michael Greer argues that the deindustrialization of the Rust Belt was stage one of American collapse. Because what that means is actual productive infrastructure was cannibalized in order to keep the system going. So now America is now less economically viable now because it cannibalizes productive infrastructure in order to meet other superfluous needs. So it's going to be phased down. But if we want to go, like, so Rome took centuries to fall, right? By the time you get to the actual barbarian kingdoms, you know, it's like 500 AD. So it's, you know, it could be 100, 200 years before we get to that extremity. But also, if we're talking about energy, right? It's just a switch, right? You just flip the switch off and everybody's in the dark, right? What would happen to an urban city if all power was cut? We can sort of see that in Ukraine now when the Russians are besieging cities and they cut off all electricity. I mean, they kind of revert to, you know, the Dark Ages, literally.
Yeah. I think that this is a difficult topic for me to grapple with because it's so extreme and huge and technical rather than psychological. But this is obviously something that people would be asking the question, what started this? Why are we like this? What is the trigger? And I guess the trigger is, as you said earlier, it's when you simply cannot, everything takes up energy, everything costs energy, everything requires energy. And it's that point when it simply, you've lost enough of that energy resource that it is now more expensive to mine than is worth it. So you're no longer able to replenish your energy reserves without depleting them.
Exactly. It's no longer a valid source of energy to extract anymore. Now, so this is often associated with peak oil. Now, people often misunderstand peak oil. The claim that I am not making and that the advocates are not making is that we run out of oil. There will still be oil in the ground, but you have to drill deeper. You have to use all of these more complex mechanisms to get the oil out. And we're going to get to a point where if it takes oil to get oil, we're going to fall below that number. You know, we're going to fall below 3 to 1 to 3. And then below that, it's just not really viable anymore. The other thing too, is this ties into a principle in economics called Jevons paradox. So the idea that many conservationists thought was if we increase energy efficiency and maintain current levels of consumption, we can then consume less energy and then, you know, help save environmental factors. So throughout history, right, if you have a bumper crop in grain, you don't eat it all that year. You put it in the granary, which is a common sense thing to think. But what Jevons paradox demonstrates is that as soon as we have more energy to use in the industrial society, we use it. So the threshold keeps jumping up as we get more energy, which is kind of unprecedented given prior human consumption patterns.
Well, the obvious question would be, is there not an alternative energy source? And that's obviously the question. I can imagine that's what people would be asking in this scenario where they can remember a much more plentiful world, a much easier lifestyle. They'd be thinking, what went wrong? And I guess the answer is, well, we just did not find an energy source to replace the one that we were relying on. So that gets us to things like what is called renewable energy, the green options, wind power, solar power, what else, wave power, and of course nuclear. So what are the problems of those, and why don't we just switch from oil to those?
So the first problem is wind and solar, the components that they're made from are made from fiberglass or plastic, which are made from oil. So the actual components of like the windmill blades or other aspects of these renewables, or even like the solar panels, you have to have the sand to then make them into those panels. They're either A, made directly from oil, or at the point of resource extraction, you have to have trucks. If you want to mine uranium out of the ground, you have to have 80-ton trucks, and they get around on oil, and you're not going to use a battery for that 80-ton truck. So even to power nuclear power plants, you'd have to still use oil to fuel the earth movers and drills in order to get the nuclear out. The only way you could use nuclear to power them is with batteries, but battery technology is nowhere near the point where you could use it to extract the uranium out of the ground by powering these earth movers and drills.
All right, yeah, I've heard about this with regard to, was it cobalt mining? Something, I've forgotten what it was now, but it's actually more energy intensive to get the mineral than it is to use. Then it's worth it. So this ends up being a self-defeating thing. The exception to all of this seems to have been nuclear. So what would you, because people tend to say, well, but there's nuclear or thorium reactors. Do you know anything about those and the prospects of using those? Obviously, bearing in mind that the world seems to be against nuclear energy just now.
So even if nuclear were to be used, right, there's only so many systems that could be replaced. So with electricity, you can power homes, you can power businesses, you can power stationary objects, and also trains. But the problem is for transportation. So in Europe, they have more railroads, so that's less of a problem. In America, we have cars. And I don't think there's enough rare earth minerals for batteries for EVs. Given all the other uses they're going to be put to. The other problem then is extracting the uranium. Now, you might say, okay, we can recycle some of the uranium that we already have and keep recycling it, but you still have to keep digging it out of the ground. And also you still have to dig the rare earths out of the ground to then make the batteries and all these other things. And with extracting minerals, extracting a mineral from an ore that contains half of the concentration requires twice as much energy. You can't keep doing this ad infinitum. And so it's at the extraction of the resource that this starts to break down, because you can't really power these things with electricity en masse, which is the kind of energy a nuclear plant would create.
Right. Okay. So then to get back to the notes. So you say we're in the current period we're in this current period, just now, the early stages of collapse, and you think it began sometime in the 70s, the US Rust Belt, and there are three broad categories: consumer goods, resource extraction, and state services. We already saw a hollowing out of state services in the 2008 austerity crisis. I don't know about America, but maybe we needed to do that, but I don't really think that did happen in Britain. I think that was largely hysteria in the media about that, but anyway, and you said now more or less flatlining the future of growth and scientific utopianism has not occurred. That is a big thing, because for the last 80 years, 100 years, well, more really, 200, 300 years, we've been talking about industrial progress, then more recently technological, digital, and even nanotechnology in the last 20 or 30 years. That's been, and genetic engineering, things like that. So do you think that these, are simply not going to happen? Are they now off the agenda for the future?
So there's two things to think about on this. If you look at, say, predictions for the year 2000 from the 1950s, wildly off as to what 2000 would look like. And if you looked at a prediction of 1950 from 1900 based on expected technological development, wildly off. So part of this is it's the sales pitch. You've got to oversell the product so that people will want to buy it, right? And so part of it is we've all been upsold a certain narrative of technology, which never actually comes true. Each time we hit those milestone years, we don't have what we want. I mean, it's kind of funny. Before this, I watched the trailer for Terminator 1, and that was 1984. And it said that by 2018, they'd have Terminator robots. And it's like, because it said when the guy goes back to help Sarah Connor, he says, well, this model won't exist for another 40 years. So that'd be 2024. Well, we're almost in 2024, and there's no autonomous robots, not like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator. They thought they could push that far enough ahead to make it believable, right? But as we get closer, also the movie Blade Runner takes
place. Blade Runner was set in 2019, wasn't it? Something like that.
I think Blade Runner is 2018, 2019. Mm. And we don't have we don't have those replicants yet. So part of it is the upsell. But let's see what we do have. We do have, you know, these smart, you know, quote unquote, general AI programs like ChatGPT. Not to get into the whole argument, but I don't think strong AI, you know, HAL 9000 is possible for various metaphysical assumptions. But smart, you know, the general AI that can like write computer code or correct your spelling or, yeah, that will just end up replacing a whole bunch of people, which white collar people, right? It's one thing when trucks would, self-driving trucks replace blue collar people, say Trump and Andrew Yang warned about and Tucker Carlson. It's another thing when the white collar folks get replaced. So that'll create social pressures that I don't think we're really prepared to deal with. And also these technologies, there's the law of diminishing returns, right? I think what a lot of people forget is that you can only push a technology so far before you can't really go further. A good example would be the gun, right? The basic principles of the gun haven't really changed in 400 years. They've just gotten more refined, better, right? We went from bows and arrows to slinging lead. We haven't really gotten to something new yet. It's like the next quantum leap, I don't know what that would even look like in projectile weapons. But we've reached a kind of like limit in what you can do in that field.
See, this is why it always used to fill me with doubt. When I would hear Stefan Molyneux saying, talking against Ludditism, and he would say, well, the free market, there's no such thing as some technology makes people obsolete, because new jobs simply emerge because of the new technology. The new technology doesn't eliminate employment. It creates employment. New things happen that wouldn't have happened without the technology. And I think surely that can only happen for so long before. And like with AI, as you were saying, it's not just the working class who, and they've been made redundant by various technological advances over the decades to a great extent. I mean, I think we had a huge working class in Britain, and probably in America as well. We had a huge working class because we had a huge industrial a need for them to work in factories and mines and so on. And since World War II, and again, I know this is a different story in America, but since World War II, we've deindustrialized to a great extent. We simply don't need a large working class anymore to do these jobs. And so, yeah, they have just ended up on welfare, on dole, on drugs, and in despair. And that's sort of inevitable, given the fact that our culture, our technology has advanced to the point where robots do the jobs that they used to do, but do it much more efficiently and do it without complaining and unionizing. Yes. So it's inevitable. That's one thing. But the middle class were always able to feel safe because, well, a robot can't design the graphics that I do for a living. Well, yeah, now they can. Yeah, now the robot can. Now the software, an algorithm that can run from anywhere in the world and can run 1,000 times a second, can do that. So yeah, the middle class is screwed as well. And so this is what I mean about technology. Eventually, you can only claim it's just sunny uplands indefinitely. You can only claim that for so long before the Luddites, if they weren't correct, you can at least understand what they were. If they had succeeded, people would now be employed. Whereas we have the situation that they didn't succeed, and so people are now listless and in despair. So you've got to wonder what would be better. Would it be better for us to not have such advanced technology and people would have a purpose in life? So yeah, do you have anything to say about that?
Actually, there's a lot to say about that. But even before ChatGPT threatens to wipe out white-collar jobs, back during the Obama years, the discussion in American politics was moving to an information economy. Well, that just privileges high-IQ people. So there's still vast swaths of the population that can't compete economically, even if theoretically new jobs are created. They're not high-IQ enough to actually take those jobs. So it's a moot point to say you've created new jobs if no one qualifies because they're too low IQ. The other thing is we can look at all the negative externalities that technology brings. Think of like the loneliness, the mental illness. Whereas if we had embedded communities, which is what the Luddites were sort of worried about losing as well as their jobs, they were happier, right? These were people that had families, that had friends, they socialized, they had a living, well, they weren't deracinated. That's it. That's the key word here. And what technology does is it deracinates us. And I think that that's actually the mechanism by which deracination happens. Alul in his scientific society says that the urban proletariat was created when industrialization pulled people into the cities. So it literally uprooted them from these rooted rural environments. Now, that in England, that was pushed by the closing of the commons, right? So these people actually were shoved into the cities because the commons were being, you know, cut off by these aristocrats to grow sheep and other cash items instead of, you know, being used for the common people of England. And so that led to deracination, changing in property rights, as well as the city's ability to absorb them as industrial workers.
So, yeah. I think that this is, we're now seeing this situation where no one, see, with AI, with ChatGPT, nobody knows how to react to it. And it's unpredictable because we don't know how good it's going to get. And yeah, I agree with you that it's going, technology deracinates. I do think that's a general problem. And it's a general problem that people have been noting and complaining about for decades. But with the AI the way it is now, and for the last year or so, it seems to poise to revolutionize everything. And I guess the question there would be, how would that interact with the energy crisis and the catabolic collapse? I mean, AI just powers through that?
I think on the one hand, what AI would do. Okay, so I think if your question is this, correct me if I'm wrong, is that because AI is a smart computer that can solve problems, it can exponentially increase our problem-solving capabilities such that we can get around this somehow. Is that what you're arguing? Or
well, no, arguing? Not necessarily. I guess what I was asking was, are you going to have two streams at once where, on the one hand, society is collapsing and going through that process of disintegration, but at the same time AI persists, so maybe the elites will have it and they will still have the energy for it, the computer components to run it, the experts who can keep working on it, and so on?
Absolutely, yes, I do think that. So for example, in Guillaume Fay's Archaeofuturism, he sort of imagines a Europe where most of it's rural, but there's these few techno hubs in the big cities. I don't know if that's sustainable in the long run, but that could be what one phase of collapse looks like, where because the people that have the high technology will want to keep it as long as possible because it's a force multiplier. And so they will just pull in resources from all around to keep that going as long as possible. So yeah, I totally agree.
All right. So we move on to this the next note there, that is stage two, drop in energy consumption. We would expect to see first a decline in the production of luxuries, then necessities, then resource acquisition operations, and lastly, the state and its services. You want to expand on that?
Right. Now, when it comes to, I'm looking at this from the point of view of, I guess it's the deep state. What are the least essential and what are the most essential? Well, the most essential is obviously the running of the government. So paying salaries for the police, the military, the government personnel themselves. Now, and like say the Roman Empire, when it fell, right, the last thing to really give was the political structure itself, because that was what was consuming everything around it to stay alive. And so what I'm envisioning here is that, now it may not necessarily happen in this nice, neat, clean order, because of course, as we already know, in the United States, heavy industry was already shipped to China. But this is more like a theoretical cost maximization perspective. Consumer goods are necessary. You have to feed people, clothe people. They'll try to keep that as long as possible. Luxury goods are going to be problematic because they don't really add value. You don't eat them. You don't really need them. And that energy could be redirected to something else. The next thing would be you have the actual industrial productive, well, extracting the resources and then the plants that process those resources into usable goods. Some are consumer, some are for other industries to consume, some are for the government to consume. They'll still be around even after they let people starve. And then eventually that will go. And then eventually all you'll have left is the government. And the government might try to run these factories, you know, directly, nationalize them. And I make this calculation because what's the most important and what's the least important? Now, this is, you know, if you have ideological blinders and ideological considerations, it might not work out exactly that way. But this is a rough rule of thumb. I mean, I think the Roman Empire followed this pretty well. I think you're muted, Woz.
Thank you. Sorry, I had the wrong screen open. So you said those parts of the country that are deemed less essential will have services cut and be allowed to increasingly operate on their own. So effectively, they're getting cut loose. They're like bits of ice breaking free of the flow. And then power outages and disease and starvation might occur in densely populated urban areas. That's always the thing in disaster scenarios and dystopia scenarios, that people want to get out of the cities because the city has become a huge risk. It's no longer where everything happens and has a concentration of human activity. It's a concentration of disease activity and pollution and litter and so on, and also violence. So people try to get the hell out of them and into the countryside. Then you said the remaining energy would be used to prop up the core power apparatus. What do you think that would comprise in this situation?
Right. So, firstly, in the cities, we're kind of already seeing this, right? Increasing violence, increasing disease. Think of like on the West Coast with all the homeless and the needles and the disease and the drugs and all that stuff. We're kind of already seeing that. But core, so when the military-industrial complex, when it was constructed over the last 60 years, in order to ensure its political viability, it had assets built throughout all 50 states in order to ensure that it would have constituents to then support it in the both Democratic and Republican parties in the Congress and the Senate. So what I would envision is a kind of the main cities on the East Coast, the main cities on the West Coast would be the core hubs. But there'd be like a necklace throughout the middle of the country, kind of like an archipelago of elements of production and resource extraction that have to be protected to keep the two coasts going. And what that would look like, it would look weird from like a grand strategy perspective. Like, why would you have these outposts? They're not defensible. Well, they were built when everything was fine and dandy and you had all this cheap energy. So you'll have these like exposed production and extraction sites, which, you know, in the areas that become wild and ungovernable might lead to, you know, raiders attacking the convoys trying to get in and out. And that's where maybe Mad Max scenarios could happen.
Yeah. Okay. I can imagine what you're saying, because that would have been built when it was safe to do so, but now it's kind of vulnerable. So that's where raiders and marauders are going to congregate. Yeah, I understand. All right, and then finally, new equilibrium. Once we reach a total collapse of the industrial system, i.e. USSR style, we can imagine a new equilibrium developing. North America as a model, we would not expect this new equilibrium to be as resource-rich as, say, 1800s North America. so many resources have been exploited, it would be below that level. So not as advanced as 1800. So we'd effectively be losing at least 230 years of technological progress.
Yes. So there's the twofold thing here, right? One is the level that we drop in our use of technology. The other thing is how many resources will be left over for the survivors to use, right? So the equilibrium in North America in 1800, I'm not counting Mexico, I think the entire, well, Spanish diseases had already wiped out Indians. So 1500, before the diseases had wiped everybody out that the Spanish brought, you might have had at most 10 million Native Americans living in the U.S. and Canada, at most. That was based on a very rich and abundant environment, which has now been exploited for over 200 years. So that's an open question, how many people will still be living here afterwards, because so much has been depleted. And not just depleted, but poisoned, because pesticides are still in the soil. That's poisoned the soil, right? We have, depending on how the industrial waste is managed in the collapse, that could also poison aspects. So I didn't bring up the poisoning in my video, but this could be tough. I mean, it'd be, you know, it would be less than what, you know, Columbus got to see.
You mean when he arrived in America?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Because the resource level that sustained European settlement and Native Americans in those early centuries is gone now. It's all gone. We used it up. And then we also poisoned it.
All right. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty dreadful. So the question then would be, how would people survive? I mean, it's they would have to be, well, what is the bare minimum for a living? You need a patch of land on which you can grow food, and you need the abilities, the tools. You can fashion those yourself. I'm not a blacksmith. So it'd be a life of constant labor to stay alive, to grow that food and protect your property. Is that what we're talking about here? I mean, that there would be the rusted remains of technology in the ground and lying around, but they would be utterly useless.
Okay, so what I would see here is that there's a few things. So if you look at America, you talk about how would someone survive. You can envision a heat map of, say, North America, where like bright red on the map is extremely high violence. So they'd be like cities. And then blue would be very low violence, you know, these distant rural areas. And then like purple might be somewhere in the middle, right? The first thing is you want to get to the blue because the red is really bad. And that heat map would then represent like, you know, density of populations, competition for resources, things like that. People would have to, if you play on Steam Medieval Village Simulators, they have to look something kind of like that because you can't actually live on your own forever. You have to have a tribe. And that's kind of the theme. You see, actually, for a lot of the DR, this should be kind of a white-pilling message because it will force the tribe to reemerge. I remember for the last, you know, 10 years, like, the tribe is great, go back to the tribe. Well, this will force, the pressures will force people to go back to that because that will be how you survive in these environments. So I think the real issue is a social one. People would be forced to create new social arrangements where they could trust each other and work together to then create livable spaces.
So do you see this as a historical, cosmological sort of cycle, like an inevitability that eventually we develop high technology, it deracinates us, we exhaust the energy supply, and then we return to monk? And everything's base again. We become re-tribalized, and sanity, a type of sanity that we all miss now, here and now, today. We miss a certain flow of life, a certain harmony, a certain trust between people and trustworthiness between people. That naturally re-emerges. And then eventually we discover some new energy source, and it all starts all over again.
Yeah, I think that history shows us that there's these patterns. In the Western context, there were two prior examples. There was the end of the Bronze Age with the Sea Peoples and the Bronze Age collapse. Mycenaean civilization, along with Babylon and other great empires at the time, fell. And then that led to kind of a dark age. And then you had the Roman Empire, which was the second high point, and then it fell, which led to a dark age. You could argue within the Western context, this is a third high point, at least in material terms, higher than any point before. But in each civilization, people were saying, well, no, we weren't going to fall. It's not going to happen. And then bam, it happens. And they're like, we didn't see this coming. And because I think that ultimately this is the result of, you can analyze this from many different perspectives, but the collapse analysis is primarily energy use. And you just can't consume an energy source indefinitely. Eventually, and there's a distinction that's made in the collapse discussion, renewable and non-renewable. So if you rely on wood and animal products and water for your energy sources, and you have reasonable levels of consumption, that's sustainable. You don't have to worry about a massive crash into the ground. What does happen is if you have to use, say, unsustainable, for example, even before modern technology, mining, right? If you need, say, you know, gold mines, eventually you deplete the gold mines. A famous example, Spain. In the ancient world, Rome, you know, mined Spain for centuries. But when the Middle Ages ended with the United Spanish Kingdom, they didn't have the gold mines anymore. They had to find new gold mines in the New World because the Romans had dug it all up. And you then collapse because you don't have any more gold to exchange as currency now because you've dug it all up. That's a non-renewable resource, right, for the point of view of human consumption. And if you build your empire or civilization on large-scale consumption of non-renewables, this will inevitably happen, I think.
Yeah. So is this the same thing, in your view, as Spengler cycles? Or it's just that it's sort of tethered to the very tangible thing about energy source?
Well, that's a very good question. Spengler, I believe, takes more of a cultural, religious perspective, right? Like, if a spirit becomes degenerate and decays, it then falls.
But, I mean, ours has, though. I mean, it does seem to be quite coincidental.
Well, but see, that's the point. I think these two cycles are in tandem, and it's really a perspective issue. Right, because the cheap energy creates decadence, right? It shields us. It's a moral hazard. We don't have to pay for what we do. And yeah, I think Spengler is looking at this same process from another perspective.
Yeah, it seems like it. All right, so I think that you've described it again. You've done the same thing as before, where we've raced through an awful lot very fast, and I'm kind of taken aback. What one final question? You've said it has already started. I agree. I think that's clear. You've said it's impossible to predict when we will reach rock bottom. It could be centuries from now. It could be decades from now. It could be years from now. Presumably not years from now. Presumably more like 100 years. So therefore, with all of that in mind, and bearing in mind what you've said, what should people take from the viewers watching this stream right now? What should they take from this? I'm guessing it's not a matter of how to prepare. It's more a question of what to be aware of. What would you say?
Right. So I think ultimately for the point of this discussion, what I'm trying to do is create a change of consciousness, a change of perspective. So, you know, within the investor world, right, there's certain things you always vest in. Don't bet against this, right? Or bet against this, right? And a lot of people have been conditioned to not bet against technology because so far it's yielded such astounding results. How could anyone bet against this? But the Roman Empire was the same way. How you can't bet against Caesar. He's not going to fall. But then one day Caesar falls because the system reaches this critical mass. And one, it's to sort of undermine the sort of technological fetishism, the sort of technological utopianism. It's not really what you think it is. It's also to show you that, okay, in Isaac Asimov's The Foundation, he also is dealing with a collapsing intergalactic empire. And he has a group called The Foundation, which is like, well, we kind of see all this coming. So we're going to build like a lifeboat on this other planet where we can like start reversing the Dark Age. And that's a really interesting idea. I think Asimov actually has a really good idea on how to start thinking about this. But the problem is we have to start thinking in a different way before anything else can happen, because I believe thought precedes action.
Oh, certainly. And that was why I phrased the question that way, I mean, how to prepare for this. Well, you could. You said also that we could talk about practical solutions, but it's the reason I didn't ask that is that it seems like quite a naive question because of the sheer magnitude of what you're talking about. But certainly, if you want to go into that.
Well, so for example, if we look at this is sort of like a what's his name now? There's that liberal political theorist who says, you know, imagine if you were the most disadvantaged person in society, and then make laws for that person. I forget his name, but that principle of like liberal meta political thought, that's sort of like one of their foundational principles. And it's like, okay, well, imagine, you know, if you're a single individual in the face of collapse, you're kind of in that position. And it's like, well, okay, but in this case, you're asking a different question. What can you do as an individual to position yourself that when sort of history breaks in a certain direction, you can sort of break with it. You can go along with the grain because you're ready now. You've seen it coming. You're ready. You're going to go from one train to the next train to the next train rather than going off of the wrong train and not making it through this whole process. And part of that is developing sort of eye for what is coming in the sense of this formalist structure, but then also developing a sort of like mindset of what I would call the world historical perspective. And Spengler's a great example of this. He's a historian who looks at all of world history and tries to derive general principles. Arno Toynbee does the same. Obviously, that's for the theory cells to do. But once the theory cells do that, they can then distill basic best practices, right, for everybody else to follow, which are derived from these universal historical norms. And I think that this is a key thing that people can start doing now. Right. Even if you don't have capital, even if you have all these other problems, you can start applying what I call best practices in order to prepare. In one of my videos, I mentioned three. One of them is stop eating seed oils. So for anybody that knows about Bronze Age pervert, rogue nationalist and Sobra, they all talk about the dangers of seed oils, polyunsaturated fats. Before industrial civilization, nobody ate that because it didn't exist as a food source, except in fish. And so don't do that. That's bad for your health. And that'll help you. People need to, this is a key thing. We are stuck in the machine because we have been essentially mentally and physically crippled. And what I want to help people do is uncripple themselves so they can actually leave the machine if and when it becomes necessary. And that becomes changing how you think, changing how you eat, changing how you work out, all of these things. And so even if you're ready, right, imagine you're, you know, a sick person in a hospital. You can't just up and leave until you're better. And the machine keeps us sick by certain patterns of behavior, certain mental thoughts, certain foods we eat, certain drugs we take. So sort of clear all that out. This is more of like a, sort of like say, hey, look at this problem first and then start looking at your life and how the machine controls you. And how you can begin unplugging, you know, jacking out of the matrix so that you can prepare. So the problem with prepping and preparing is we aren't really able to yet. We still live in the machine. We still don't know how the machine controls us.
So dare I mention Uncle Ted? Would you say it's a good idea for people to embark on that kind of lifestyle where it's learning how to live without the machine?
Well, in some cases, yes, right? But I sort of envision a phase out where like you have multiple colonies of people at various stages of decoupling. So if you're a normie stuck in the machine, going straight to living Uncle Ted would be too much of a shock. Too much of a shock. You couldn't do it. So you'd have to have like almost like way stations where you have progressively more and more decoupling, so that normies can be processed through a system to be able to get out. And that processing will include diet and exercise, changing how you think, undoing what the machine did to you, and then learning the kind of practical skills to live in that way.
But that's funny. It's like a sort of red pilling, red pilling pipeline boot camp for normies. Yeah, and of course I shouldn't chuckle too heartily because I would be as much in the dark there as anyone, because I am, you know, like most of us these days, a creature of luxury. So I see what you mean. You're talking about creating an apparatus by which people could be transitioned out of dependence on the machine and actually made, transformed into independent, self-sufficient units again. That's interesting, isn't it? It's like tooling people up in order to survive without, well, all of the comforts and systems that we know so well.
Right, because the problem is, to use the Matrix analogy, the shock would be too great, not just psychologically, but people don't yet have the internalized skills to be able to live that way. They know how to interact with, you know, screens and keypads and mouses and all these other things, but, you know, do they know how to milk cows? Do they know how to cut down a tree with an axe? No, they don't. They have to be taught that. And there needs to be this sort of like phasing out. And so you change how people think, you get them to understand that they're in trouble, and then you begin to create structures, social structures and material structures that help people leave in this phase. So they'll be like detox zones. You know, you've eaten a lot of poison, you've taken a lot of drugs. Well, we'll have to detox you for a while before you can go to the next level.
Detoxing. That's a good one. Detoxing from the machine. I like that. All right. Well, I think, there's one super chat from Black Pigeon Pilled. Two. Have you read, oh God, have you read Desiderius Erasmus' book of the same name? Or did your channel name come from a different source? So where did you get the name?
That's where it came from.
It came from Desiderius Erasmus.
Yeah.
All right, okay. There you go. That's his curiosity sated. Are you aware of Immanuel Wallerstein's world systems theory, which, in my opinion, began with Halford Mackinder's heartland theory? And if so, how can this continue in the absence of American leadership?
Now, I am not aware of Immanuel Wallerstein, but I am aware of Mackinder, so I can't really answer the question, unfortunately.
What you could do is tell the rest of us, what is Halford Mackinder's heartland theory?
Oh, that, I could tell you that. So the heartland theory is this. He was writing at the very beginning of the 20th century, and when the British Empire was still seen as at its high watermark. And he was afraid, and at this point, Great Britain and the United States had patched up their old hostilities with the great détente of the 1890s. And so you have the two great naval powers of the world figuring out how to control the world. The heartland is that part of Eurasia in which naval power cannot access. So that would be Eastern Europe, most of Russia, Central Asia, and then northwestern China. And he believed that if that area were ever unified under a single political ruler, they could build up a power base to challenge the Anglo-Saxon sea powers, and we couldn't stop them because we couldn't deploy naval forces in that area to break up that consolidation. And so a lot of geopolitical theory for Great Britain and later the United States in the Cold War was to break up any great power in the heartland, which is in part why Russia is being targeted now. Because the Soviet Union was supposed to lead to a collapse of more than just what it was. They wanted the whole thing to break down.
Right. So when was that theory?
1904 or 5.
Right. Okay. I've never heard of that one before. But yeah, I can understand the logic of it. Would that still hold now in this, you know, age of drones and so forth?
It would. Now, things change, right? So missile technology, aircraft technology, both with reach and speed, do render the heartland targetable. You can't target it now in a way you couldn't have before. But navies still can't really deploy assets in that area. and, you know, marching land armies through Central Asia is a challenge. You know, the U.S. lost in Afghanistan, so it's no easy task. I mean, how many missiles are you willing to fire, right? And then how many missiles does Russia or China have to shoot them down? I think ultimately what geopolitics shows us is that technology can mitigate certain aspects of geography, but it can't eliminate them. So I think the Heartland Theory is still relevant, even if it may be not as relevant in the age before flight.
That's interesting, because I think geography is one of those things that technology does try to eliminate, or tries to nullify, along with other limiting the factors that would naturally be limiting. Technology tries to overcome them and nullify them. And you see that when the internet would be the perfect example, where you and I right now are God knows how many thousands of miles apart, and yet we're having a real-time discussion. I mean, it's still, you know, it still amazes me. I'm going to say it's still, whenever I take the time to really think about it, it's astonishing, really, what we do and how much we do take it for granted. And you can't help but take it for granted because it's just so easy and available and there all the time. But when you think about it, it's amazing what we have. But this is one thing. I remember making this point a long time ago in 2014. I remember making a video with a friend, and I said this, that geography, we kind of think that it just doesn't matter, but if it doesn't, then there isn't much anymore. You know, there isn't abstract principles, your people, your genetic group, but you know, geography seems to be as key, as crucial as your group. I think the place and people, the homeland, Heimat. This is. Yeah. See, there's always that sci-fi notion that the human race could be on an incredible, opulent spacecraft out in the middle of nowhere. But, attachment to place then is gone. I can't imagine that. I just can't imagine that. It's a thing. Elon Musk talks about colonizing Mars. And I can't imagine that, you know, people having no attachment.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's a thing. There was one question that people asked. Someone asked, hold on. Oh, yes. Can you summarize your, let me see the exact wording. Can you summarize your issues with mold bug?
Okay. I can. And I've already done that before. So the idea of the Dark Elves subverting the liberal elites to take over the current existing structure and then running it with, quote, our guys, unquote. I would argue it doesn't actually work. So in the French anti-capitalist Marxists, Deleuze and Guattari, they describe a concept called deterritorialization. So you go from the territory, the original social or political arrangement, you deterritorialize it by breaking it down, and then you re-territorialize it into something new. So, concrete example, Roman Empire, that's the territory. Barbarian invasion and conquest, that's deterritorialization. New barbarian kingdoms, that's the reterritorialization. All Moldbug is doing is just reterritorializing what they were doing. So, decolonial movements in Haiti and in Africa, they got rid of the European leaders, but they kept the same structures of financial and technical and political control. And it was wasted political effort because meet the same boss, new as the old boss. You didn't really change the problem. The problem is the structure that you're taking over.
All right. Okay. Everyone seems to have issues with mold bug. And I did study him early on a long time ago. Gosh, yeah, 10 years ago or more. And I just could never get into it, honestly, because he was far too verbose. And I hate that. Maybe I could be accused of it myself with my own written work. I'm not sure. But he can certainly be accused of it. And he spends ages, paragraphs where a sentence would do. And I just can't stand it. It's bad manners, I think.
Well, there is a lot of bad manners, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, so, oh yeah, here's another question. But yeah, about Moldbug, I've honestly just not got that much interest in him. And I don't say that to disparage him. I'm just saying that it's not, I read it 10 years ago, his open letter to open-minded progressives or something like that. And I just didn't get much out of it, honestly, which I guess is probably a failing in myself rather than in his work, I suspect. But anyway, here's one more question. Revolt Against the Modern World asks, does Praise of Folly have any recommendations for books on collapse, whether philosophical, historical, analytical, or practical? Books on collapse.
Well, yes, I do. So the first one is Joseph Tainter's Collapse of Complex Societies. That's where this now he's analyzing historical examples. Three of which he looks at are the Western Roman Empire, the Maya civilization, and the Chaco culture, which is, I guess, in South America. The Anasazi, so that would be the American Southwest. That's a more historical, analytical account of this. And then you have, at a more popular level, James Howard Kunstler, who wrote The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic, both of which are excellent introductions to this idea. Right, that's more like normie-friendly, whereas Tainter is a lot more like hardcore and difficult to get into if you're not familiar with the subject material already. And then you have John Michael Greer. He's written a lot too, about collapse. I'm trying to find the one he wrote. Can't seem to find that right now, but yeah. So Kunstler and Greer and Tainter all are must reads on this. And if you're a normie, start with Kunstler. Very easy to understand. He takes all these complex ideas and distills them down.
A question out of left field. Are you familiar with the writer Edward O. Wilson?
The evolutionary biologist?
Yes.
Vaguely. I mean, I know the name.
I just wondered. I actually read a book by him a long time ago. It's not the kind of thing I would usually read, but I read it. It was called Biophilia. And it was related, similar to the Gaia hypothesis, but he was talking about a love of the Earth, obviously from the name, a love of the natural world. Is that something that you think it would be worth our while? Do you think that's something that we're going to have to get into?
Do you mean, okay, so I haven't read the book, but saying that...
Just the general notion that of becoming more at one with the natural world again.
Yes. I do believe that the key aspect of deracination is taking people away from the land. Urbanization is intrinsically deracinating, though not all to the same degree. Obviously, modern day New York is far more deracinated than ancient Rome.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the technology just... You know, in ancient Rome, people would still need to do a lot of things for themselves. We're orders of magnitude more deracinated than they would have been. All right. And then finally, Stoic Saxon. Woes, what about the Logos? It seems you guys were on that topic at the beginning. To my mind, this is the right way of thinking you touched on. Any comments on that? Thanks, guys. Logos. All I know from this, this is something I know that EMJ talks about it. That's really all I do know about it, actually.
So, I have his book on the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, but I've never actually read it all the way through. I've read parts of it, and I've seen some EMJ's lectures. Logos or logos in the Greek just means word or and so Christ, of course, is the incarnated logos in the Christian concepts. So on the one hand, you get this from the Stoics. The Stoic philosophers start to use this word to describe the sort of divine mind that orders the universe. And Christians then identify that divine mind with Christ. And that's what E. Michael Jones is doing. He's saying this Christ-mindedness is what is lacking. that's, I think, in a nutshell, I think what he's getting at here.
Yeah, that was my notion of it as well, from what he'd said, was that he was talking about it as the source of truth, or the truth, and Christ would be a personification of it, and Logos is rising, yeah, and truth is returning. I don't know. It's just, I'm just not Catholic enough or Christian enough to buy into that. And I, or rather, let me put it more fairly. It's just not something that that appeals to me, that I can identify with. If you're going to talk about order and an intelligence, the divine, a godly order, I can understand that. It's when they use terminology that is specific, or ways of framing it that are specific to their religion, that it just alienates me. And I don't even say that as a complaint. It's just a fact. I realize that people with religions are obviously going to do that inevitably. Every people do that. Jargon seems to be a natural tendency among people. The word logos is literally Greek for fuck's sake, says Nigerian diamond mine. Yeah, I think that's clear. That's obvious. And someone also recommends Lewis Mumford's The Culture of Cities. It's also a good book on cyclical history. I think you mentioned that, didn't you?
I might have mentioned Mumford. Mumford writes about the mega machine, which predates modern technology, but it's this process of accumulating centralized power in urban centers and empires to then do more mega machine stuff, like launching out armies and public works. It sort of is this centralizing process, which, again, eventually falls apart, as we've... to use a mythopoetic sense, what I'm talking about is this is a kind of Babel impulse. We're trying to build this tower to God that always keeps falling down.
All right. Duno says, Mars, colonizing could only be done by men who don't feel a tie to a homeland. That makes sense. Could it be that those colonizers of a brand new land actually feel a visceral tie to the land they build, feel a need to defend it against the people it was supposed to be built to support? I think you needed to rephrase that question. I'm not sure that makes sense, but I also don't think that people, if it's Mars colonizers, they simply can't have a visceral tie to the land because it's new to them. So it's not like their ancestors were there. It's not like they were born there. So therefore, they cannot possibly have the kind of tie to that land on Mars that we have on Earth. It's just not, it's impossible. Could they have fondness for it and hopes for it? Yeah, sure. That's a completely different thing.
Well, assuming Mars could be terraformed, which I guess is an assumption we're making here, couldn't it be possible that future generations of Martians could? So think of like European settlement in the New World or in Africa. So... when the Algerian Revolution happens, the French that have been living in Algeria for about 100 years now feel like that's their home, even though they're relatively new to the area.
Yes. All right. Okay, well, let's leave it at that then. Let me see. Yeah, I think there aren't any other super chats. Oh, Judy did ask a question, but I'm not going to ask it because I think I don't think Praise of Folly is into that. So I'm not going to ask that. Okay. I don't know why. So Darby has asked a question. I don't know why he's asked it for you, but maybe you have Italian ancestry. Do you?
Not to my knowledge. It's right. Mostly Northwest European.
Okay. Well, for some reason, Darby has nonetheless asked you, is that new Italian PM, Giorgia Meloni, the biggest disappointment of 2023? That's a nice lightweight question for us.
Well, I don't know if I'd say Meloni's the biggest disappointment in 2023. There's been a lot of disappointments this year. But definitely coming in and not delivering on that sort of like nationalist populist message is definitely disappointing.
Yeah, of course it is. Sorry, there's actually another question from Judy that she asked before, so I will ask you this one, and this was probably a good one to end on. Could you give a brief explanation of your religious faith and how it helps you?
Right. So I would argue that I'm a Christian, more specifically a Christian whose religious tradition and ties go back to the 16th century Anabaptist tradition in Europe during the Reformation. And then how that helps me, what Christianity does is, in my life, it contextualizes. So think of like the story of Job, right? Why is this happening? Well, it's a theodicy, right? But so what Christianity and what religion does is it helps create a framework in which to understand both the world that we're living in and why things both good and bad happen. Whereas without it, I would say that you might have another one, I guess, or maybe no framework at all. But that's the framework that I use to make sense of all these things.
All right. That's a very concise answer. All right. Okay, well, this has been another very good stream. Short, but you've packed an incredible amount into it. So thank you. I think people have found it interesting. They're in the live chat. There are lots of engaged comments throughout the stream. All right. Okay, well, any final things to say before we finish?
I would just say it's always a pleasure, Millennial Loves. It was great discussing Collapse. And I guess I'll just shamelessly shill now. You can follow me on Locals, Twitter, Telegram, Facebook, Buy Me a Coffee, Subscribestar, and Substack.
All right, excellent. If you send me those links, I'll add them to your profile and then they'll be shown. All right. One final thing I should say, this isn't my usual wheelhouse, this kind of technical and engineering mechanistic kind of stuff. So I'm sorry if I've not been optimal in my responses to you, but I've done my best. It's just not the kind of thing that I'm attuned for. So,
thank you.
Nonetheless, I think we've done okay. So, all right. I'll be back tomorrow night. Let's see who's on tomorrow night. Oh, Kevin McDonald, and then No Chance, and then Red Ice, and then Der Schattenmacher, the German. So, well, obviously. So that's quite a mix indeed. It's going to be an interesting night. So, all right, I'm sure I'll see many of you then. But in the meantime, Praise of Folly. Thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you for having me, Millennials.
All right. And everyone else, I will see you tomorrow night.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.